All right, you guys, here's how to support the show. First of all, sign up for the feeds at scotthorton.org. Second of all, go to scotthorton.org/donate. And if you go there, if you donate $20 now, usually PayPal is the easiest way to do it. Then you go to the front of the line to get the audiobook when it comes out. I swear, I'm working on it. It's coming out soon, but I gotta, hey, I'm meticulous. What can I say? You like that about me. I'm working on it. It's coming out. Anybody donates $20 now, you go to the front of the line to get the audiobook for Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. $50 donations to the Scott Horton Show, and you get a signed copy of the book in the mail there. $100 donation, you get a QR code, silver commodity disc. You scan it with your phone, you get the instant spot price. It's the greatest invention in the history of currency. $200 donation to the Scott Horton Show gets you a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks from listenandthink.com. And you can also sign up to do regular subscription donations, monthly donations at PayPal, $5, $10, $20, $50. Those are great if you want to do that. And if you sign up at patreon.com/Scott Horton Show for more than $1 or $1 or more per interview, I mean, you get 2 free audiobooks from Listen and Think Audio. That's at patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. And the rest and all of that is at scotthorton.org/donate. Also, shop amazon.com. All your Christmas shopping and all that stuff, you know, by way of the link on the front page of scotthorton.org. And leave me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher. Come on, man, you love the show. Go and write about how much you love it. And if you read the book and you like the book, review it on Amazon for me, too. That'd be nice.
War is the improvement of investment climates by other means. Clausewitz for dummies.
The Scott Horton Show.
Taking out Saddam Hussein turned out to be a pretty good deal.
They hate our freedoms.
We're dealing with Hitler Revisited.
We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? So we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand.
No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States begin military action in Libya. That action has now begun.
When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I cannot be silent in the face of the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
All right, you guys, introducing Congressman John Duncan. He represents Tennessee's 2nd District. And was one of the few Republicans who voted with Ron Paul against Iraq War II. And a few since then, actually, that he's had a chance to vote on. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, John?
Well, thank you, Scott. It's an honor for me to be on here with you. I've listened to several of your programs and heard John with Tom Woods and so forth, and I really admire and respect and appreciate your work.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate that. I'll make sure to send you a book. I'm trying to, well, let's just start with the news first. They say you're retiring, and I'm here to talk you out of it because... Well, I think, and I don't practice what I preach very well at all here, you know, I'm about as a libertarian can be, but I think what we really need more than anything else in this country right now is anti-war right-wingers, and especially veterans such as yourself. It says here you're in the Army Reserve and the Army National Guard, which, good enough for me, rank a captain, and what we need really is anti-war veterans, and especially conservative and libertarian types who don't sound like, you know, reminiscent of Vietnam era hippie protesters, but 21st century anti-war on terrorism guys to, you know, as Ron Paul has done so much, has accomplished so much in doing, is destroying that narrative that you got to be Jane Fonda to oppose these wars. And that actually there's a whole thing about just being so conservative you oppose the wars, so smart that you know better than to continue with this policy. And I think you do such a great job of communicating that message just by example, just by being there and voting the way you vote and taking the stands that you take. I'd really hate to see you go.
Well, thank you very much. Ron Paul's a real close friend of mine, and we worked together for years. In fact, he and I probably voted more alike than any two members of Congress all through the years. Although I have a pretty interesting story in that regard, in that when I first came to the Congress now 29 years ago, I believed everything the military-industrial complex said, and I actually voted for the first Gulf War because I went to all these briefings with Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf and all of that, and heard about this these elite troops that Saddam Hussein had and how much of a threat they were. And then I saw those same troops surrendering to CNN camera crews and empty tanks. And I thought then that the threat had been greatly exaggerated. And then a few years later, I was speaking to a group at the Greenbrier, and I saw in the paper that an article called America's Forgotten War, and it said we were bombing, we were spending $4 million a day bombing every fourth day to enforce a no-flight zone against a country that had no real air force. And then I read a front-page article in the Washington Post a couple of years later where one of our bombs had gone astray and killed six little boys who were out in the field playing soccer, and it told of the anguish of this one father whose little son had had his head blown off. And so when that second Gulf War rolled around, in 2003, I was very much leaning against it. And then they called me down and to a little secure room in the White House with Condoleezza Rice and George Tenet and John McLaughlin. And that was a pretty interesting meeting itself there, too.
Well, why don't you elaborate?
Well, among other things, there had been a front-page story in the Washington Post a day, either that day or a day or two before, where Lawrence Lindsay, who was the Harvard professor who was President Bush's main economics advisor, he said a war with Iraq would cost us $200 billion or more. And I asked about that, and Condoleezza Rice said, oh, no, it wouldn't cost that much, maybe $50 or $60 billion, and we could get some of that back from our allies, which had to be the worst estimate in the history of the world. And then I asked him, if you could get past all the traditional conservative positions of being against huge deficit spending and massive foreign aid, and conservatives being the biggest critics of the UN, and we were going to war to enforce UN resolutions, if you got past all those traditional conservative positions, did you have any evidence of any imminent threats? And they didn't. And in fact, George Tenet confirmed that in his first speech at Georgetown University the day after he resigned. So it was ridiculous. And there were all kinds of articles. I remember Fortune magazine had an article that said if we went to war in Iraq, we would make U.S. soldiers sitting ducks for Islamic terrorists. And there was another article in U.S. News World Report that said, why the rush to war? So, we were just far too eager to go to war, and it was totally unnecessary.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you bring that up because, you know, an important part of the narrative now is, well, everybody thought so and this kind of thing, but not only is that not true, it's also not true that only left-wingers were against the war. And, you know, left-wingers were against the war because they were smart to not trust Bush and Cheney and these guys who were clearly getting away with a bonus war, exploiting the ignorance of the American people by trying to conflate Saddam Hussein and Osama. See, I did it myself. Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden together and this kind of thing. But there were plenty of people, as you say, the president's father's alter ego, his best friend in the world. I mean, that's what he calls him, Brent Scowcroft, the
right.
General Scowcroft, the former national security advisor, and Bush Sr.'s best friend, wrote a thing in the Wall Street Journal saying, don't attack Saddam. That was the title of it, and that was one of his warnings, too. Colleen Rowley, who was the FBI lawyer from Minneapolis, who could have stopped the attack if they'd let her do her job back in August of 2001, she wrote in her thing when they made her, you know, Time Magazine Person of the Year and all of these things for being the great whistleblower. In her letter to the Senate, she warned that this is going to make Osama look right about us, and it's going to turn a land full of a lot of Sunnis into a lawless kind of a territory in the meantime when we overthrow the government and unleash chaos there. Who knows what might happen, but it's almost guaranteed to benefit people like Osama bin Laden. And, of course, Ron Paul said the same thing over and over
again.
Well,
what's really sad, Scott, 80% of the Republicans in the House were against Clinton's bombings in the former Yugoslavia. And I believe to this day that 80% of the Republicans in the Congress would have been against the war in Iraq if it had been if Gore had been in the White House. But because it was George W. Bush was in there, they all felt and they got tremendous pressure to vote for it. So they did. But I will tell you that it shocked my district that the morning the night before that vote, one of our television stations here in Knoxville had a poll showing 74% were in favor of the war, 9% against, and 17% undecided. But when I did that vote, it shocked my district. And for about 3 or 4 years, it was clearly the most unpopular vote I ever cast. In fact, one Sunday I was supposed to go speak at this Baptist church, and the minister called me on the Monday before and said his biggest contributor, his main deacon, was going to pull out of the church if I came. And he was very apologetic, and I didn't mind because it just gave me a free Sunday that I didn't think I had.
You must have been reelected just weeks after your no vote, though, right?
No, because the election wasn't until 2000. The next election wasn't until 2004.
Oh, I thought they held the election in October of. I mean, the authorization vote in Congress in October of 2002, and then you were up for reelection just a few weeks later, right?
You're right. I'm thinking, yeah, because
the war
was in 2003, but the vote was in 2002. You're correct. Mm-hmm.
But you were reelected just a few weeks later, despite the unpopularity of that vote.
Right, but I did have, it was 2 years later, when it was 2004, when I had this, one of the mayors in my district ran against me totally on the war.
Oh, I see.
But what was for 3 or 4 years a very unpopular vote, it slowly became probably the most popular vote I've ever cast.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sorry that we haven't talked this whole time, because I always thought it was heroic. Anyone in the Republican Party who voted with Ron Paul on that, they were taking a braver stand. Well, never mind Ron. Against that was taking a braver stand than the Democrats. And by the way, I think more than half the Democrats in the House were good on this and voted against it.
Yeah.
So we should give them, I never give them any credit for that. In the Senate, more than half of them voted for it. But in the House, at least the majority of the Democrats voted against it.
There were six Republicans who voted against it in the House.
And yeah.
I'm the only one left, but there were three sort of very liberal or moderate Republicans, and three, and then Ron Paul and John Hostetler, and I, John Hostetler from Indiana, were three, conservative or libertarian members who voted against it.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, we can talk about the war on terrorism in a minute, but just overall, I mean, your article here, we're running it at antiwar.com. It also ran at the Ron Paul Institute website as well, ronpaulinstitute.org.
Yeah, and lewrockwell.com put it on today.
Okay, great. Yeah, I meant to run it on the Libertarian Institute site. I just hadn't got to it yet, but I will.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
It's a great piece. It really is a very well-written thing. It's called "There Is Nothing Patriotic or Conservative About Our Bloated Defense Budget." And I have to say that even though I know better, because I've been reading these gold bugs all these years in the Mises tradition, you know, I know better, and yet still my life experience thus far, 41 years, is that, yeah, booms and busts and sometimes inflation, but there ultimately seems to be no ceiling on how much money our government can print and how high the national debt can get. I remember people being absolutely outraged that the national debt was $4 trillion when Reagan and Bush were done.
Right.
And so now it's 20. And apparently the sky's the limit, and yet you're writing an article here saying that, no, there's such a thing as being able to afford a world empire or not. Is that so?
Well, that's the way I look at it. And what I wrote about, I guess what got me really started was that I was hearing the president and many others say how the Defense Department had been cut drastically and was depleted and eviscerated and all those words like that, when I knew that that was totally false. And in fact, as I say in this article, one of the Capitol Hill papers described the bill as a $700 billion compromise bill. The $700 billion is not the whole story, because the military construction bill, for instance, is a separate bill, and then they get extra money through all sorts of emergency and supplemental appropriations, and also in the omnibus bill that we do at the end, they got extra money in the flood bills that we did for Texas and Puerto Rico, and on and on and on. And so I said in this article that the Defense Department, it seems to me, that it's just like any gigantic bureaucracy. When it comes to money, they want more, 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 more.
All right, hang on just 1 second again. All right, you guys, here's a couple of books for you to read. No Dev, No Ops, No IT. And those are one word each. No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the right-hand margin there at scotthorton.org. Also, The War State by my friend Mike Swanson. It's a great history of the rise of the military-industrial complex after World War II. And also, he gives great investment advice at wallstreetwindow.com. Buy your precious metals from Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. They do great work. They've been around since the 1970s. They charge a very low premium. They charge no premium at all if you buy with Bitcoin. That's Roberts & Roberts at rrbi.co. Get it? RBI? rrbi.co. Well, I played T-ball when I was a kid. I'm more of a skater, you understand, but still. All right, libertystickers.com for your anti-government propaganda. 3tediting.com to make your book read right. Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom so that you know a bunch of stuff about how things work. Darren'sCoffee.com if you like waking up in the morning. And expanddesigns.com. You want a brand new 2018 model website? Come on, your website, man, it's old, it's out of date. You need a new website. You go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you save $500. You know, I'm sure you saw the headlines here. We were joking about it on Twitter about how they claim at least they're using F-22s in Afghanistan to attack a heroin refinery, you know, meaning a house where they're supposedly processing opioids for the black market. And and the F-22, meanwhile, is supposedly meant for taking on MiGs, right? It's an air-to-air. It's not even supposed to be a ground attack plane in the first place. It's just that the F-35, they can't use that on anything yet. And I don't know if they threw too many F-18s in the sea or what, but it seems like a mismatch, you know, a howitzer and a mosquito and this kind of thing, right?
Right. That's right.
It's amazing to think
of. Well, and then, too, I pointed out that to something that almost nobody thinks about. We spend in 2016 we spent $177 billion on new equipment. We spend similar amounts every year, or have for the last several years, and most of that equipment, it doesn't wear out after just 1 year, or it's only used one time. I mean, you buy any tank that we bought in 2016. Or a ship that we bought, those are still around and still should be very usable, because we're not up against a big army someplace.
Mm-hmm.
But and then the other another point in my article was that I said we had way too many officers, and you know, as you pointed out, I was in the Army, and I started out as an enlisted man and went up to became as high as captain. And I believe national defense is one of the few legitimate functions of the national government, but you can go ridiculously overboard on everything. And I don't think we should be trying to run the whole world or provide the defense for all these other countries.
Hmm. Well, you know, I guess when it comes down to it, I mean, it really does go to not just the post-Cold War order, but even the post-World War II order, right, where America says, first and foremost, that the UN Charter is the law, and that means that UN resolutions will be enforced by someone, and so that's us. And so that's it. Like, that's our... And it's actually kind of ingenious in a way, right, that it's this international charter is the charter for the U.S. Army to be the enforcement branch, the world police, as they call it. And
well,
so
that's right.
And I wonder, do you reject that? Is it time to leave NATO and the United Nations and go back to, or not necessarily back, but go forward to an entirely different sort of a order there?
Yes. Well, let me tell you something. I don't believe in world government, never have. I believe that government... closest to the people is the best. And I agreed with the foreign policy that candidate Trump advocated in his campaign. In fact, that's one of the main reason that I really wasn't going to endorse anybody. But then it got down to where there was just three left, and one was Ted Cruz, and one was John Kasich, and Donald Trump. And I thought of those three. At first, I knew that John Kasich didn't much have a chance, and so I thought that President Trump, of course, to me anyway, was a lot less hawkish than Ted Cruz, and so I went ahead and endorsed Trump. And of course, I since then have written an article. I wrote an article for the American Conservative magazine about my disappointment on President Trump's actions in regard to Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, and he's escalating in the Baltics, which was that was the only single best thing about him. That was the real thing that gave him the advantage over Hillary on foreign policy, because he said a lot of horrible things about foreign policy too, but he wanted to back off of Russia. And even now, he just tweeted last week, hey, we ought to get along with Russia, forget the haters and the losers. And yet he's escalating troop numbers and equipment in the Baltics and getting ready to send weapons to the Ukrainian junta there, you know.
Well, I know, and then of course it's all over the world the same way, and all over the country. I mean, just last week or week before, they announced that we were going to send 1,000 Tennessee National Guard troops to Poland, and I've sure got nothing against the Tennessee National Guard. I'm all for the Tennessee National Guard, but I don't think they should be put into Poland on the border of Russia. I mean, the way I look at it, what if Russia was to put 1,000 troops on our Mexican border or our Canadian border someplace? What would we think about that?
Yeah. So, well, you know, people don't like that shoe on the other foot stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, not these days anyway, because it doesn't really look very good.
Well, and then also on Iran, I was one of three that voted against increasing the sanctions on Iran, because NPR called me up and asked me why, and I said, well, Iran, by all of our intelligence agencies and the people who are supposed to know what is going on, they say Iran is doing everything that we've asked or everything that was demanded through the agreement. And so I said, you know, I just didn't think we should slap them when they're doing, slap them in the face when they're doing everything that we supposedly wanted them to do.
That's good. Yeah, you know, this is another one like Iraq War II, where you have to have some backbone and a willingness to actually learn what the truth is, because there sure is a lot of sloganeering on the issue of that nuclear program and that nuclear deal. And to get to the truth of it, you have to actually be willing to be honest and not just have some, you know, whatever partisan bias confirmed and that kind of thing. But then when you look at it, boy, they sure do have a tiny proportion of the nuclear program they used to have, and more inspected than ever, and can't really argue with that very much if you talk about the details. It's better to just say it's a bad deal really loud and hope that washes away any other argument, I guess. But
you know, one quote that you might be interested in, yeah? That, you know, I mentioned in that article about Scott Berg's biography of Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, and how that he said we had, we had 30 enlisted for each officer during World War I. But it also says in that same biography that Winston Churchill in 1936 told a New York newspaper editor, America should have minded its own business and stayed out of the World War. He's talking about World War I. And Churchill said, if you hadn't entered the war, the Allies would have made peace with Germany in the spring of 1917. Had we made peace then, there would have been no collapse in Russia followed by communism, no breakdown in Italy followed by fascism, and Germany would not have enthroned that Nazism. Now, that's a fascinating quote coming from Winston Churchill, and especially the way that Churchill is venerated by the neocons and by Bill Kristol and the Weekly Standard crowd.
Mm-hmm. And of course, they and everyone else seems to always invoke Adolf Hitler. Well, what are you going to do? What about Adolf Hitler? What about World War II? You had to jump into that. Germany hadn't attacked us, but still, and we should have attacked earlier. Everybody knows that. We're all raised with that. And yet, this is the perfect answer to that. There would have never even been Adolf Hitler the Führer
Churchill
at all
saying.
If it hadn't have been for Woodrow Wilson in World War I.
Yes, and the peace agreement that basically destroyed Germany economically, that's what gave Adolf Hitler a platform. So, and even though in more recent years, our foreign policies in the Middle East have made us a lot more enemies than friends, I think.
Well, it looks that way. Wait, so, let me get to the terror war in just a second, but I want to ask you about nuclear weapons. I'm just curious. I don't know if you've ever written about this or anything, but of course, this entire policy started with Barack Obama. It was a compromise with the Senate over the START II treaty that, okay, we'll sign this treaty, but at the same time, we're limiting our nukes. We're going to expand them and revamp the entire industry for making them and all of these things. $1.2 trillion. You see how they've already added the 0.2? It'll be $3 trillion by the time we're done, right? Trillion-dollar program. Now, a $1.2 trillion program. It's just 0.2, you know, 200 more billion.
Oh, I know.
Anyway, to expand and basically revamp our entire H-bomb industry. And I wonder about how this works on Capitol Hill, because I'm sure there's just a bunch of, like, hey, I'm some idiot congressman, and everybody knows we got to be tough and vote for more nukes all the time and just not question it. And yet, it seems like there's probably also, like, lobbyists for Honeywell up there making sure. And so I wonder if you have any anecdotes or anything, you know, and can teach us a little bit about how that works. Because I have to say, you know what? Sorry to continue on this, but honestly, as much as I already knew everything about how every lobby works in D.C. and how they use their power and influence and steak dinners and bribes and campaign money and all the things that they do to win power and influence, I somehow had carved out this exception for the H-bomb industry and just thought that that's something that's so nationalized with the national laboratories and with the military monopoly that's somehow the economics of all of that rent-seeking don't count for the H-bomb industry. And yet, I really am wrong about, like, that was just some fantasy of mine. And the truth is, it's just like selling boots to the Army, right? Same thing.
Right. Well, the way it works is just like it's worked on the F-35. They the most expensive plane in the history of the world, they parcel it out and they put some little segment of all of these programs in this state and that state, and pretty soon they find ways to have something in almost every state. And then if you don't vote for it, they say you're voting against jobs or money coming into your own district and so forth. That's a lot of it, but it's really sad the way it works. But I will say, while I'm on here, that you've got to, while I'm going to be leaving after another year, you've got some good people. In fact, you've had some of my friends like Walter Jones and Thomas Massey and Justin Amash, and there's some others. And even though we're a very small number in the Congress, I can tell you that out in the public, it's becoming non-interventionist policies are appealing to a much larger portion. In fact, I think a majority of the people now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think I really agree with that. All the polls say that people are tired of the wars. It's not a priority, though, unfortunately. But, you know, and this goes back to the beginning about me asking you, and I only am half serious, obviously. You have your life and your priorities and things like that. But about asking you to stay there is just about, as I was saying, the example set that you don't have to be any kind of liberal or socialist or progressive or Hollywood person or Nancy Pelosi, not like she's anti-war. You don't have to be any of those things. You can, if you like your identity as a conservative, Christian, Republican, you can keep it. That's fine. Just be anti-war now, because it's just crazy to continue on like this. And when it's put that way, you know, this was the example that Ron Paul set was, hey, look at me. I'm the most square guy in North America, right? Like, still married to his high school sweetheart since they were 16. And you know, a Protestant of German stock, Republican from Texas, congressman, Air Force veteran, right? So then when he says, and I'm very anti-war, in fact, I'm more anti-war than any left-winger you ever met, then it kind of blows people's mind for a second, but then they realize it's not a contradiction. He's the one being consistent. He's the one who knows what he's talking about. He's the one who's on the right page. And then they go, hey, cool, right? So now they don't have to feel like, oh, they have to identify with Michael Moore. They can identify with Ron Paul. They can identify with John Duncan and go, well, here's a guy who's a captain in the Army Reserve. Here's a guy who's a Republican Congress, however many terms, in the Republican Party in Congress, and he's saying enough. And so maybe it's all right to say enough, because that's what this is all about, really, right, is whose side are you on and social psychology and all that. You got to support the troops. But if the troops say supporting me means bringing me home, then now what are they going to do? They're going to have to go with that, right, if supporting the troops is the highest priority. You understand what I mean.
Oh, I understand. So, and let me tell you, I wrote an article, I think it was in early 2015 for the American Conservative magazine about how the Republican Party used to be and still should be the Peace Party. And so I think you might be interested in looking back at that that article.
You know what?
It goes right down your...
I want to suggest, too, you should write some things for the Washington Times, because, you know, they've run some good things by Colonel Douglas McGregor. And that's a
good
place.
I've had several columns over the years in the Washington Times also, and even though I'm retiring, I hope I can still write some articles and speak out in every way that I can. But I've got 9 little grandchildren. I'm very fortunate; they're all here in Knoxville, and I have 4 grown children. But I missed a lot of things when they were growing up. But the best decision I ever made was I told my wife when I first went to Washington that I wanted our kids to be raised in Tennessee. And so now they're all here, and I need to spend a little time with them.
Right, I dig it. Well, happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you very much.
I appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, it's been a great honor for me, and I tell you, I hope you keep up the good work for a long, long time.
Well, I appreciate that a lot. I'll get with your assistant there and send you a book.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks again.
Bye.
All right, you guys, that's Congressman John Duncan from Tennessee, the 2nd District there in Tennessee. I'm Scott Horton, and you guys know the deal. ScottHorton.org for the shows, LibertarianInstitute.org for the Institute, FoolsErrand.us for the book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and read the viewpoints at antiwar.com. Follow me on Twitter, @ScottHortonShow. Thanks.